We are looking at clinical care and operations of the Toma VA Medical Center in the pandemic. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. So all veterans, their spouses, and caregivers of veterans are eligible to receive COVID vaccines at their local VA facility. That's from the Veterans Health Administration. This hinges on supply, and priority goes to the more than 9 million veterans enrolled in the VA. Veterans, what do you think of services and clinical care at Toma VA? Have you been hospitalized? Are you able to get treatment and access VA services in these times? What are barriers to care? It's 800-642-1234. Stacy Williams is a pharmacist and the Toma VA Medical Center Associate Director. Stacy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. It's so nice to have the opportunity to talk to you and your listeners today. I'm so excited and so very proud to be able to talk about our service to veterans during the pandemic and during this trying time. And VA has been kind of at the forefront of the vaccination efforts and patient care. So very excited to be here. Thank you.
Well, give us a snapshot, if you will, how Toma VA has been operating in these times, operating in the pandemic.
Oh, sure. You know, immediately last year when the pandemic was declared, we at the VA brought together groups of people with expertise across various subjects, from infection control to our physical plant policies, procedures, the whole nine yards, to really radically change what we did here at the medical center. We put every effort into ensuring the safety of our veterans and our staff, and we ensured that we followed CDC as well as Veterans Health Administration guidance related to COVID-19 and related to efforts to maintain staff and veteran safety. We had to adjust the access to our campus. We certainly had to work on other methods to keep our veterans safe. And one of the things that was really very pleasing and very exciting was the adoption of some of the innovative technologies that are available.
Like telehealth.
Exactly, like telehealth, that allowed us to see veterans in different ways, but also that same type of technology allowed our inpatient veterans to connect and communicate with their loved ones during the pandemic as well. So not only using the telehealth type modality for healthcare, but using it to keep our veterans connected.
What has your hospital capacity been like for treating veterans suffering from COVID? What have you seen there?
And so what I can tell you from that perspective is that while we have not seen a significant influx of, you know, COVID-positive veterans, we do did offer care, and we did make some modifications to our physical plant to ensure that we could provide that care safely to veterans and maintain the safety of our staff as well.
Has your staff had the adequate access to N95 masks and gowns and other PPE?
You know, we are very fortunate, Kate, because from our perspective, we are also a part of, you know, VHA is one of the largest healthcare systems in the U.S., and we are part of a smaller network or group, I should say, of sister hospitals. And all of our sister hospitals, we collaborated very effectively throughout the pandemic to ensure that all of those hospitals had adequate access to the PPE necessary. You know, we helped out where we could for other hospitals, and they helped us as well. And we actually have done some storage of some of that PPE for some of our sister hospitals also.
Stacy, have your sanitation protocols changed around reusing medical supplies or reusing medical equipment in the pandemic?
So we have done a number of things to ensure that our policies and procedures for reusable medical equipment meet the standards that are set forward for COVID. And we have a dedicated team in our sterile processing services who really has done a fantastic job of ensuring safety.
We're talking with Toma VA Medical Center Associate Director Stacy Williams about clinical services and operations in these times. Veterans, we want to hear from you. What would you think of the services that Toma VA provides? Do you use these services? What is your feedback? 800-642-1234. Russ is joining us from Stoughton. Hi, Russ. Go ahead.
Well, my opinion is I totally disagree with your guest about the VA being in the forefront of pandemic services. When everything broke out last March or whatever it was, all a VA would tell you is if you don't feel good, stay home. Do not come to the hospital. Do not walk into the clinic. And they were doing nothing for months. And I finally was... They sent me an email and scheduled me for a vaccine about 3 months ago. But prior to that, they were doing nothing. They were offering no good information on what to do or what they were going to do.
Russ, what did that mean for you in managing your own health situation, your own health care?
Well, you know, I'm a widower. I live alone, so I try to stay away from anything, you know, any outdoor gatherings or anything to keep myself from, you know, being in any kind of a virus spread area. But I was very disappointed and still disappointed with the VA's program, which was doing nothing.
Russ, thank you. Stacy, go ahead.
Well, Russ, I'm sorry to hear that you were disappointed in the care that you received. I know that the experience of each and every veteran has been different throughout this pandemic based on their individual case and individual circumstances. But I'm sorry to hear that your experience was less than optimal.
A tangent here from Russ, the Department of Veterans Affairs says VA healthcare providers are providing COVID tests, but you have to have an appointment. You can't go in person to a VA facility without an appointment. Is this a barrier?
Kate, that's a great question. And, you know, every VA has, you know, really worked hard to make sure that scheduling is, you know, a maximum way to use our resources. There are opportunities in certain circumstances for walk-in care as well, but scheduling does allow us to make the maximum use of our resources.
How has vaccine rollout been for veterans at the Toma VA?
The vaccine rollout actually, I think, has gone very well. We started vaccinating back in December following the CDC hierarchy. And as such, we have been able to very effectively and efficiently, by utilizing a multidisciplinary team, roll out vaccine and do vaccinations not only for veterans but for caregivers and spouses. And, you know, we have the supplies of vaccine, and we've actually been continuing to do outreach in our communities to continue to encourage people to receive the vaccine.
What is the impact of the J&J vaccine? Because the VA had been using that vaccine. It was stalled for a time. What do you see there?
So we still see usefulness of the vaccine. That allows us to reach a population that would prefer like a one dose. There's obviously some additional concerns with the J&J vaccine, but our clinical team is prepared to address and answer those questions for veterans.
Pharmacist Stacy Williams is Toma VA Medical Center's Associate Director. As a veteran, have you had difficulty getting access to the COVID vaccine? Or how about getting your questions answered about the vaccine? Did Toma VA help you? What questions do you have about your care or the care of a loved one at Toma? Be part of this, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Stacy Williams on the Ideas Network. We're discussing clinical care and operations of the Toma VA Medical Center that provides health care to veterans living in western and central parts of Wisconsin. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A VA Office of Inspector General report last July found Toma VA met requirements and quality measures for dispensing opioids for long-term pain management. We'll look more closely at the report findings. What is your question about VA therapies and treatment plans? How are you or a loved one treated at the Toma VA? What was your outcome? Join in 800-642-1234. Stacey Williams is the Toma VA Medical Center's Associate Director. Let's bring in Jody now in Lake Geneva. Hi, Jody. What's your experience?
Hi there. I just wanted to say thank you to the VA. My father was a Vietnam veteran, and we utilized the VA in Toma, and we've only had nothing but great service. He passed away in October, and I wanted to give a shout-out to Mary Dunn up at the WASA office, who has just been amazing getting things taken care of through the VA. So we just are so appreciative of everything they've done for our family.
Jody, thank you. Stacey, that is such good sentiment.
It certainly is. And Jody, my sincere condolences on the loss of your father. We truly appreciate your kind words to our staff, and I will make sure that they have an opportunity to hear that, especially at our WASA location. So thank you for those kind words and my sincere condolences to you.
Can you explain a little bit how the satellite centers work with the main Toma VA Medical Center, how that setup works?
Oh, certainly. So, Kate, we have four satellite VA clinics. One is located in the community of La Crosse, one in the community of Wausau, one in Wisconsin Rapids, and one in Owen. And those four clinics provide outpatient care and outpatient services to our veterans, from primary care to mental health care. We certainly also have our whole health care spread to all of our community-based clinics as well. And then various clinics have some specialty services such as audiology or optometry also, for example.
I want to focus a little bit more here on pain management, because it was 5 years ago this month that Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs, the committee, released a 350-some page report saying, look, there were serious problems of overprescription from at least 2007 to 2015 at Toma, and that the VA Office of Inspector General didn't do anything about it. What has changed?
Well, you know, one of the great things that changed at Toma is Toma was a flagship site for the implementation of the whole health system of care across VA. So we were one of 18 initial flagship locations. Whole health really allows us to turn the conversation from what's the matter with you to what matters to you. And it offers alternatives to veterans from that perspective to opioids and to medications. So those alternatives could be things like battlefield acupuncture, Tai Chi, yoga, aromatherapy, healing touch, and there are just a whole host of other modalities as well. Whole health also involves a personal health coach that works with each of our veterans to really ensure that they are getting what they want from their health care. And so that has been a significant change within the Toma VA since that initial incident was published and was investigated in 2015.
There were also concerns about reporting structure of the Toma VA Pharmacy Department, that reporting to the chief of staff led to conflicts of interest that discouraged pharmacists from reporting concerns about overprescribing. Do pharmacists, and I know you're one, do pharmacists have a voice, a role in questioning prescriptions?
Most certainly we do.
Is there anything more you can elaborate on that?
Well, I feel like what I can say is that, you know, our pharmacists have been encouraged to report when they have concerns. They've been given a voice and have had a voice in our Opioid Safety Initiative, which is a committee that works to manage safely opioid use at the medical center. And certainly pharmacy also plays a critical role in our whole health system of care as well.
We're talking with Stacey Williams, the Tomah VA Medical Center Associate Director, taking your questions, 800-642-1234. Steve is joining us from Ironwood, Michigan. Hi, Steve. What is on your mind?
How you doing? This is not necessarily Wisconsin, but I'm sure Michigan and Wisconsin are the same. I live in Ironwood, Michigan, and there's a local VA clinic here. Every time in the last 3 years, I've had to go see them for something important, but, you know, bad cold or whatever, they'll say, oh, we're booked for 2-3 weeks. They say, go to your emergency room. So I've done that, the local hospital here. And you go to the emergency room, and 3 months later, you get a bill that the VA turned it down. They've never paid yet. You got to fight it. That's not a good thing to do.
Hmm. Stacey, have you heard concerns like this?
You know, so that's a great question, Kate and Steve. You know, I apologize to hear that you've had issues with billing when you've used community services. The Tomah VA has a very robust community care department that ensures that our veterans are able to seamlessly receive care between the VA and the private sector, be it hospitals, emergency departments, and the like. And they're certainly vested in ensuring that our veterans have the best experience and that care is as seamless as possible.
So what would you say to Steve there if he can't get an appointment, or any veteran, 2 or 3 weeks out? What do you do?
Well, you know, if you do have to utilize care, you know, in the community, that it's very important that you reach out to your specific patient care provider, let them know that you've had to seek care in the community, and then they can connect you with the appropriate individuals at the VA to ensure that care is seamless.
Stacey, I want to look at women's health here for a moment. The Office of Inspector General found concerns with the Tomah VA's community-based outpatient clinic, women's health primary care providers. And how is Tomah VA addressing concerns of women's health?
So Tomah VA is obviously very invested in providing care to our female veterans as well. We do have a women's veterans program coordinator whose sole role is to assist in improving the experience and improving the care for women. And we also have more and more providers that are being trained through many residencies to provide care specific to women veterans as well.
You know, the data shows female veterans, they're a growing group. They're expected to reach 16% of the veteran population in the coming decades. What will Tomah VA do to handle this growth?
So we continue to evaluate the growth, because even though it's 16% of the total market of veterans, we have to really ensure that we are basically individualizing that statistic to the Tomah VA. So our Women's Veterans Program Manager has been doing a fantastic job along with some market analyses that we have done to ensure that care for women veterans continues to improve at our medical center and our outpatient clinics as well. We just moved into 2 new outpatient clinic locations, and they have rooms specifically set up for women veterans, set up a little bit differently than the standard exam room, and really designed to improve that women veterans experience, and that will continue to be our norm as we move forward.
I want to land here on such a troubling area, which is veteran suicide, and the data, it just doesn't bode well. More than 6,000 veterans who have died by suicide from 2008 to 2017. What is Tomah VA doing in this area?
We have a very active suicide prevention staff and we actually have embedded suicide prevention in our whole health system of care as well. We also have a very active social work department that has numerous different resources that are available to veterans as well. And we continue to take suicide as one of our most sincere and most critical patient care priorities, and we put resources towards that as much as we can to ensure that our veterans have the care that they need.
Stacy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Kate. I truly appreciate the opportunity to speak with you and your listeners this morning. Thank you to Russ and Jody and Steve who called in. Really appreciate the opportunity and have a beautiful rest of the day.
You too. Stacy Williams, a pharmacist and the Tomah VA Medical Center Associate Director. Coming up, in the effort to stop police brutality, we look at what police liability insurance could do for accountability in the profession. That's after a news update on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Since video footage captured the killing of George Floyd, Wisconsin agencies have pledged to review their use of force policies and invested in body cameras. Corrine Hess reports families of those killed by police officers in Wisconsin are hoping the footage can lead to justice.
When Joel Acevedo died from injuries at the hands of an off-duty Milwaukee police officer last spring, his parents, Maribel and Jose, were told their son had been the aggressor. Months later, the Acevedos saw police body camera footage that they say showed them a different version of events. At a press conference in December, Maribel said the 40 hours of footage needed to be released publicly.
It's black and white evidence that there is no justification for what he did to my son. I don't care what narrative they have. It is not justifiable.
The judge in the case, William Pucan, is expected to rule on the releasing of the footage tomorrow. Joel Acevedo died on April 25th, 2020, 6 days after being in a chokehold for 11 minutes and 20 seconds. He was at a party at the home of former Milwaukee police officer Michael Mattioli when he reportedly got into a fight that led to the strangling. Mattioli has been charged with first-degree reckless homicide. His attorney says releasing the tape would interfere with his ability to receive a fair trial. Acevedo family attorney B. Ivory Lamar says the public has a right to know what happened.
You see the body camera footage, I think it paints a completely different picture, and I think that will provide the basis as to the public understanding why it's being fought so hard for it to not be made available.
In recent weeks, there have been several high-profile killings by police officers where video footage was quickly released to the public. First, former Brooklyn Center, Minnesota police officer Kim Potter was charged with second-degree manslaughter after fatally shooting Dante Wright during a traffic stop. Many believe the charges came quickly because footage from Potter's body-worn camera was released right away. Days later in Chicago, police released footage revealing 13-year-old Adam Toledo's empty hands were raised above his shoulders when he was fatally shot by an officer the month before, a very different scenario than what police originally reported. A Wisconsin Department of Justice survey released earlier this year found three-quarters of the departments that responded used body cameras. Of those, about 88% say they've been using the devices for at least a year. Cynthia Lum is a criminology professor at George Mason University. She says body cameras are only as good as the policies that dictate how they're used.
People and the police can feel and have perceptions one way or about one thing, but I think the more important thing is whether or not body-worn cameras actually deliver on the outcomes that we expect from them.
In the Milwaukee suburb of Wauwatosa, police officers have been wearing body cameras since February. Sergeant Abby Pavlik says the cameras are always on, and when an officer is about to have an interaction, they activate the camera. Videos are saved for at least 3 months. Pavlik says Wauwatosa would release footage on a case-by-case basis.
Anytime we release footage or any type of kind of an open records, we base it on the public's need to know versus we weigh that balance of what needs to be seen to preservation of, you know, evidence or somebody's personal information.
Jay Anderson Sr. wishes Wauwatosa officers were wearing body cameras in 2016 when former officer Joseph Menza fatally shot his son. Menza approached Jay Anderson Jr. while he was sleeping in his car. Family members say he was inebriated, but Menza says Anderson was reaching for a gun when he shot him. Menza was never charged in the killing, but Jay Anderson Sr. thinks his story may not have held up if there was video of the encounter.
A body cam is what we need on every police force in the United States.
As the Acevedo family awaits the murder trial of former Milwaukee police officer Michael Mattioli, they hope the release of the body cam footage will provide clarity in the moments that led to their son's death. Corrine Hess, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, police liability insurance, could it be part of the solution to issues of police accountability? Each year, millions of taxpayer dollars are spent in covering the costs of lawsuits over police misconduct and brutality. Like physicians and lawyers, officers are subject to civil liability for their actions on the job. But unlike other professionals, police aren't required to carry individual professional liability insurance. Are you in law enforcement? What's your take on liability insurance in your line of work? It's 800-642-1234. Deborah Ramirez is a law professor at Northeastern University. She works on police accountability with academia, law enforcement, politicians, and community leaders. Deborah, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Katie. It is a pleasure to be here.
Well, Deborah, you advocate for police officer liability insurance. Explain how it would work.
Well, I think before I explain how it works, your listeners probably need to understand what the state of police accountability is right now. Because professional liability insurance is trying to solve a particular problem. And the problem, as you know from the radio clip that we just heard about a young man being killed in Milwaukee, is that police brutality right now in the United States remains unchecked because the police unions, through collective bargaining, have created a system that makes it nearly impossible for police chiefs to discipline or fire police officers for misconduct. So people say to me, Debbie, why does this occur over and over again? Why do we continue to see these tapes? And I say because right now in the United States, we don't have any way to get bad cops off the streets. We don't have any mechanism to weed out the bad officers so that the good ones can thrive. And your listeners, I'm sure, will understand this because they have been watching TV and radio. We know that the only way that we are dealing with police brutality in this country now is to react. Once an officer engages in brutal policing, we try to react. Indict them in the criminal justice system if we can, hold them liable with damages. So in the last trial with Derek Chauvin, we indict him for murder, and the Floyd family gets $27 million in damages. But the criminal justice system is ill-equipped to provide the kind of accountability we need, and the Floyd family gets $27 million, but the city of Minneapolis is going to pay 100% of that. And so, Derek Chauvin will pay not one penny.
Yeah. So using, you know, Chauvin as an example, how would liability insurance have played a role in this?
Well, that's a good question, because we looked into Derek Chauvin's background. He had been on the force for 19 years. Mm-hmm. He had 18 complaints. Two of them were sustained. He'd been involved in multiple shootings. Now, 18 complaints is a high number compared to the other officers. His complaint numbers alone should have triggered some sort of review. Most officers in doing his kind of work get one or two complaints in 7 years. And there was a very interesting sustained complaint. You were talking about body cameras and car cameras. In this sustained complaint, a woman was going 10 miles over the speed limit. He stopped her, pulled her out of her car, frisked her, and interestingly, his car video and audio were off. The department sustained this and issued a warning letter. But all of this should have triggered concerns by an auditor long before Chauvin met George Floyd. So had there been a professional liability insurance system in place, his record would have triggered high premiums. His continued record of recklessness would have made those premiums soar, and he would have been priced out of policing before he ever met George Floyd.
So how would you force insurance companies to take an active role in regulating, in moderating police behavior and not look at it as another market opportunity, another way to grow the insurance industry and make it more lucrative?
Well, it may be a lucrative product for the insurance company, but it's 75% cheaper than what we're doing now. Hmm. In Minneapolis alone, okay, you have a $27 million settlement just from the Chauvin case. And 3 years ago, a $20 million settlement from the Damond case. What insurance is going to do is save taxpayers 75% of what they're paying out because the officers who engaged in police brutality are priced out before those settlements and judgments come in. So the way it would work is that either the state or the municipality would require police officers to carry professional liability insurance, just the same way that doctors do, lawyers. All officers have to carry it in order to police. And just as when doctors engage in reckless medical practices, operate on the wrong leg or arm, when they do that, their premiums go up. And if they continue to do it, their premiums soar and they're priced out of medicine. In the same way, when an officer begins for the very first time to engage in reckless or dangerous policing acts, illegal searches, seizures, assaults, excessive use of force, the officer's premiums rise, and if they continue in this behavior, their premiums skyrocket, and they should be priced out of policing. Now, under this system, the officers and their insurance companies pay the costs of police misconduct, and those with dangerous histories, tendencies, or indicators are priced out of policing by premiums that reflect the actual risk of their dangerous behaviors. And the beauty of this system is that it is trying to get ahead of the problem by preventing, detecting, and deterring the kinds of terrible police brutality that we see on tape.
We have Northeastern University law professor Deborah Ramirez explaining what mandating police liability insurance would do to the profession. What's your take? Should we treat police officers like doctors about accountability for their mistakes? How do you feel about cities paying out settlements brought against officers who significantly harm or kill someone? Still time, your thoughts. Liability insurance for police, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Northeastern University law professor Deborah Ramirez is explaining the idea of liability insurance for police and having insurance companies manage risk and be active regulators in police behavior. And Deborah's here for 10 more minutes. Tom is joining us from Burlington. Hi, Tom. You're on the Ideas Network.
I would like to ask, Bob Kroll was the head of the Police Federation up until 21. I think he is now retired or gone. And the question is, do we need some kind of a federal program? He had been in public had been a racist and had encouraged this bad behavior with people. And how can we do we need a federal law or something to get control of this situation?
A federal oversight program for policing, Deborah?
Policing is local, and I'm not sure that we need a federal system. But Tom is correct that the unions are controlling policing right now. If you were to talk to any of the police chiefs, especially the big city police chiefs, they would tell you this. They can't hire the officers that they would like to hire to be guardians of the community. They can't promote those who are engaged in problem solving and excellent community policing. They can't discipline those who are using excessive use of force, and they can't fire them. All of the managerial tools of police chiefs have been, through the collective bargaining process, bargained away. And so what Tom is saying, he's really right to look at what is wrong with police unions and how much power do they have. The professional liability insurance system is a way to check that balance and to do something about it. Now, what we are saying needs to happen has to happen at the local level. So first, your listeners could contact their legislators and ask the state legislators to put in a bill that requires all of their police officers to carry professional liability insurance. Second, the legislators could narrow the scope of collective bargaining. They could say to the unions, as a matter of public safety, you may no longer bargain and force the municipalities to pay 100% of the cost of police misconduct. You may no longer bargain about disciplinary procedures for police officers. That should be done by the police chief. And you may no longer bargain about how and when an officer can be fired. The union should be concerned about health issues, health insurance, working conditions, but they should not be in charge of hiring, firing, and disciplining police officers. And right now they are. At a municipal level, your listeners could ask their municipal leaders to say to the police as part of the collective bargaining process, we have heard from our taxpayers and they no longer want to pay 100% of the cost of your misconduct. You, the police officer, are going to be liable for the first, I don't know, $10,000, $20,000, $30,000. This has been done in Colorado.
And I wanted to bring up Colorado. What have been the takeaways there as they legislate on this issue?
Well, they've passed legislation saying we are not going to pay 100% of the cost of police misconduct anymore. So the first $25,000 has to be paid by the officer personally, which is where the judgment or settlement order goes. And the result of that is that the unions in Colorado came to us and to Primus Insurance, the insurance company we're working for, to say, we now want to offer professional liability insurance to our union members. Let's work together to create a product so that they won't lose their homes or resources if there's a judgment or settlement against them. And so in Colorado, it's coming from the bottom up as opposed to the top down. And the unions are actually working with us to create a professional liability insurance product for their officers.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Northeastern University Law Professor Deborah Ramirez. We're discussing liability insurance for law enforcement and how it might impact police brutality. With your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Joseph is joining us from Harrison. Joseph, I understand you're a former police officer.
Correct. And I agree with the I'm also a police behavioral scientist for 40 years, and I agree wholeheartedly with your guest. I would take it even further. I think we need to evaporate the police unions. I've worked for unions. in the private sector, and they tend to protect the low-hanging fruit, the bad apples, and all the good, top-notch police officers are being demoralized. They're leaving in droves, and I think the union needs to be evaporated because that will solve the problem. And I'll tell you right now, without unions, we will have higher quality police officers who stay, and the good cops will be reinforced, and the I call them the bad apples will be gone.
Debbie, do you see what Joseph is saying there, that this is mainly about just eliminating the union itself?
Well, I agree with Joseph, but I don't think it's politically possible. And I'm not anti-union. If the unions would act like other unions, they don't even call, police unions don't even call themselves unions. They call themselves associations because they're management. They're in control. I think the unions should advocate again for safe working conditions, overtime policy. I think they should advocate for health and dental insurance. And the things that unions normally do to improve the job. The problem with police unions is that we gave them too much power. They were allowed in the political process, like other unions, obviously, to contribute money, but they also branded. So politicians needed the police unions to brand them as tough on crime, and they wanted a blue wall behind them. That gave the police unions way, way too much power. And this is the situation we're in.
Well, what about the argument that police are public servants? We shouldn't have private companies, private insurance companies mixing with public service.
I understand that argument, and they are public servants, but all public servants have checks and balances on them. And usually the public servants are responsible to a managerial apparatus. And we have basically told the chiefs, you can't hire, you can't fire, you can't discipline, you can't terminate. That means no one's in charge except the unions. And insurance companies are not going to be dictating day to day what happens in policing. A similar example of this is Moody's, which is a private company that creates risk assessment scorecards for municipalities that borrow money. Okay, Moody's does not tell the municipality what to do or interfere with day to day operations. They're private, but it rates them in terms of credit risk. Similarly, insurance companies here are creating risk assessment scorecards for police officers. It doesn't interfere with the day-to-day decision-making. It just assesses risk and prices it out. And I want to go back to what Joseph said, because many police officers have called me after I've given these presentations, and they say, you know what? You're right. When we saw that tape of Chauvin, we were horrified. We were demoralized. We were ashamed. That is not who we are. And they said, what I like about your system is that you actually are trying to identify the officers who are having problems, and they're easy to identify. They're getting restraining orders, etc., and you're trying to price them out or give them treatment.
Deborah, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
Deborah Ramirez, professor at Northeastern University School of Law, works on police reform and racial profiling issues. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.